What does the prefrontal cortex have to do with resilience? Can you change the way the brain reacts to stress? And how can we rewire the brain for more resilience? We'll get into all that and more in this bonus session with Dr. Linda Graham and Dr. Ruth Buzinski.
Hello, everyone, and welcome. I'm Dr. Ruth Buzinski, a licensed psychologist in the state of Connecticut and the president of the National Institute for the Clinical Application of Behavioral Medicine. And I'm so glad that you're here. Today, we're going to talk about resilience and what the brain has to do with resilience. You'll find out all about it in the next hour. My guest is Linda Graham. She's a marriage and family therapist and a licensed psychotherapist in San Francisco, as well as a meditation teacher there. She is the author of Bouncing Back, Rewiring Your Brain for Maximum Resilience and Well-Being. So, Linda, thank you for coming and welcome.
We're
awfully glad that you're here.
Happy to be here.
Let's get right started with, let me ask you, why did you decide to look at and think about the brain and resilience?
Well, resilience meaning the capacities to cope with the ups and downs in life, the challenges and crises that we face in life with some skill and with some adaptability. Bouncing back from adverse circumstances as well as our adverse conditioning. That's what we as clinicians are trying to help our clients with all the time, to help them cope better with stress and trauma. And so I was interested in techniques that would strengthen a sense of self to be able to do that. But at the same time, I'm a meditation practitioner, and the freedom from suffering in that tradition is being able to let go of the self or let go of the contraction of the self. So I was interested in integrating tools from those two paradigms, both relational psychology and mindfulness practice. And it was the neuroscience that really gave me the clues to do that, because it turns out that mindfulness and empathy both are two of the most powerful agents of brain change known to modern science. And as I could begin to understand what happens in the brain when we're practicing mindfulness or reflection, as well as when we're practicing empathy and compassion, then that helps me better teach clients how to change the patterns in brains so that they can be more resilient and even rewire patterns from the past.
That's interesting. Now, to go further into that, you talk about conditioning and neuroplasticity as two processes that work together to change the brain.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, what do you mean by conditioning in this case?
So conditioning is how the brain learns from experience. So now we know through neuroscience that any experience at all, positive or negative, causes neurons in the brain to wire and to fire. And when we repeat those experiences, we'll repeat those patterns of neural firing. And the more those patterns of neural firing repeat, the more they strengthen connections between them and create new pathways and circuitry. So conditioning is how the brain learns in the first place. And over the time, patterns stabilize, and we develop sort of our automatic habits for responding to life events. What's new about the neuroplasticity is in the last 15 years now, neuroscientists know that the brain can change lifelong. We can take that for granted now, but until 15 years ago, we weren't so sure about that. So when we know how to harness self-directed neuroplasticity, and in the book, I offer new conditioning, reconditioning, and deconditioning as mechanisms of brain change, then we can teach the clients how to use the tools that will use those three mechanisms to actually rewire their patterns of response.
All right, so we're going to get into that whole thing about reconditioning, deconditioning, and so forth. But before we do, let's just talk a little bit more about resilience. Let's just lay the groundwork for a little more in terms of resilience. When in the lifespan can we start building resilience?
So the capacities for resilience are innate in the brain. They're hardwired in by evolution. And in fact, we start developing those capacities as soon as we're born and we're interacting with other people and we're learning from them patterns of responding to life events. Are we learning to respond with anger or with patience? Are we learning to respond with engagement or avoidance? So we're learning from the very beginning how to respond to life events. And not only are we learning particular patterns to be resilient, but those interactions are shaping and kindling the development of the brain itself, especially the prefrontal cortex, which is the what I call the CEO of resilience, and we'll probably talk more about that. But the interactions with our early caregivers make the brain itself resilient, as well as learning patterns of resilience. So we can use the neuroplasticity of our brain lifelong to create new changes, not only in our patterns of response, but in the structures of the brain themselves. So it's something that we do throughout our lives.
So it starts in infancy, and it starts in our relationships, and I presumably that would most likely be our relationships with our parents.
Right.
Now, we know that there's a range of those relationships, from some that are, let's say we have, some of us have parents that are very healthy and patient and empathic and attuned and so forth, and right. other people don't. And so it sounds to me like you're moving into the whole attachment area.
Well, certainly secure attachment is the neurological foundation of resilience. So that means when the child is reaching out to an attachment figure for safety and protection and comfort and reassurance and validation, when they can get a response from the caregiver that is attuned and empathic and in fact helpful, then the baby's developing a sense of mastery and efficacy. I can get a response in a relationship when I need to. And that develops a sense of safety and trust within the developing child. But it also maintains the plasticity of the brain as it's developing so that it doesn't become too rigid in its responses and it doesn't remain chaotic. It actually stabilizes but stays flexible at the same time. So not only is secure attachment the best buffer we have against stress and trauma and psychopathology, but it's the basis of our brain staying neuroplastic, open to learning, and then we can stay open to how we respond to life events.
Now, we learned in the trauma series that if the parent has experienced trauma, him or herself, that sometimes they don't have a lot of skill. And it's not that they perhaps lack desire, but they lack the skill to calm their baby down. And so, you know, I'm sort of seeing a chain reaction here. They had a traumatic experience, and now they aren't equipped to inculcate in their infant the kind of relationship that would help the infant grow a resilient brain.
Right. And so a lot of what we do as therapists, when people come to us with less than resilient patterns or perhaps even maladaptive and dysfunctional patterns, and those can even seem kind of intractable, we can seem really stuck in them, what we can do is create a new relationship with our clients or our patients where they're actually getting that sense of attunement and empathy and compassion and acceptance that rekindles the maturation of their own prefrontal cortex. We're actually helping their brain integrate and function in a more resilient way. When you're speaking about trauma, and we sort of know partly the intergenerational transmission of trauma, one of the severe impacts on the brain is that stress and trauma activates the release of cortisol in the brain, and cortisol kills brain cells on a massive level. And what's particularly vulnerable is the hippocampus, which is where we convert our experiences to long-term memory storage. So if there's a lot of stress and trauma in the home and the developing brain is exposed to that, there can actually be damage to the hippocampus, which simply makes it harder to learn and retain the learning of new and better responses.
So I want to stop you for a minute because I want to go back to an idea that you said before you started on the trauma piece. I think what you were doing is giving a nice frame to what we're doing in psychotherapy from the perspective of, I mean, we don't talk that way, But I think that you're framing it from a brain perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that can be useful to a lot of the people who are listening. And let me broaden it from psychotherapy to parenting to teaching mm-hmm. to any kind of caregiver, any kind of practitioner. Mm-hmm. A wide range of us have a part of our roles where we're in some kind of a caregiving, helping setting, and you know, you sort of captured, and I actually guess I want you to repeat it because I want to make sure people understand and caught that. Can you tell us again, just briefly, what's happening in the brain when we as psychotherapists mm-hmm. are responding, or one way to look at what we're doing?
So anytime anybody is functioning as a true other to the true self of the client or the patient or the person that they're interacting with, that activates the resonance circuit in the brain. So that's coming from the brainstem. It's how we get our initial sense of a vibe off of another person. Basically, whether it's safe or dangerous to approach that person or be around them, and that's completely unconscious. We can often react without knowing why. But then it comes up through the midbrain, which is giving us our earliest emotional processing. And not only is it safe or dangerous, but are we feeling frightened or angry or ashamed or all of those emotional processes? And then it comes up through attunement, where we're actually paying attention to what the other person is feeling and how they're feeling being with us in relationship, to empathy, which is a cognitive process. It's verbal, it's conscious, and it's conveying the understanding of what the other person is experiencing in words with the sense that's completely understandable. It totally makes sense to me that you would be experiencing what you're experiencing. So that moves into a kind of compassion, which is accepting the situation, whatever is happening, but also accepting the person that it's happening for them or to them. And then that leads to acceptance, where the clients can begin to experience a kind of self-acceptance. So that's that entire resonance circuit is what builds, well, it's what develops the prefrontal cortex of the brain in the first place. It what builds relational resilience within the human being. And then that's what allows us to become relationally intelligent going forward. When we're relating to other people, then we can apply skills that help us be resilient, like setting limits and boundaries, like negotiating change, like repairing a rupture, like understanding and compassion and forgiveness. So we can build the capacity for those skills in our work with the clients. But I think it's also important to be able to talk about what we're doing. Not just the external stories that are happening to the clients outside in their lives, actually happening in the relationship, in the room, and are they actually feeling and taking in the good of the relationship, the good of the true other to the true self. I have also found it very empowering to teach the clients about what's happening in their brain. They like a sense of mastery and a sense of efficacy, and there becomes a conviction. Oh, these practices, these tools work. I can take this with me and use it outside of the clinical session. And clients actually really enjoy feeling more and more competent and masterful about their own brain.
Mm. Yes, I would agree. And I would say that that's true, not just for psychotherapists, but again, for any practitioner or for parents or for teachers.
That's right.
For people in a wide range of settings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's move on and let's talk about habits for a moment.
Okay.
And again, from a brain perspective.
Right.
How do we develop habits?
So many habits actually are hardwired in. We don't have to learn them. So our basic survival responses, which we're all familiar with at this point, a fight, flight, freeze, numbing out, collapsing. We don't have to learn how to do that. The body brain will do that to help us survive as an individual as well as a species. The drive to attach is one of those survival responses that we don't have to be taught. We know how to do that from the very first moments. But habits are a habit of behavior is simply an encoded pattern in our neural circuitry. And we can develop habits lifelong. The importance about neuroplasticity or self-directed neuroplasticity is that we're choosing which habits we want to develop. So we're choosing which experiences we want to have that will develop the habits we want to have. And I love this quote from Richie Davidson, who of course runs the big neuroimaging lab at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And he says, once we know that experience changes the brain, we not only have the opportunity, but we have the responsibility to choose the experiences that will rewire the brain in a wise and wholesome direction. So we're helping our clients discern which experiences actually help them create new habits, new patterns, and help them become more resilient.
So from a brain perspective, habits are somewhat developed on the basis of neurons that fire together, wire together.
Right.
Can we talk about that a little more?
Well, given that that's how the brain operates, an experience will cause neurons to fire. The more we repeat the experience, the more the neurons will fire together. They'll create more stronger connections between themselves, which creates the neural circuits and the pathways. So when we're wanting to change that, if we talk about new conditioning, we're talking about choosing new experiences that will cause the brain to fire in a different way. So we're actually creating new neural circuitry in the brain. So if, for instance, someone has a habit of being critical, how they respond to their partner is in a critical fashion, and they notice that, and they notice it's derailing the relationship. So they want to cultivate, perhaps instead, a practice of kindness or of compassion. Even intending and saying the word kindness or compassion can break the automaticity of the old habit. But then they're proactively cultivating the new habit of responding with kindness or responding with compassion. It takes repetition. It takes perseverance. But one of the things the neuroscientists have discovered is a positive practice like that will create what they call a left shift in the brain. There's more neural activity in the left hemisphere of the brain.
I want to make sure I got, though, a positive practice like what?
Like kindness or compassion or gratitude or generosity or patience or any of those positive practices.
You're talking about it as a practice, though, not the moment of being kind.
The moment of being kind repeated many, many times a day. And actually, when we focus our conscious awareness on it and take in the feeling of it into our body so that it's actually registering as a somatic resource, we're actually cultivating a circuitry that will support the experience of kindness in our brain.
Now, the problem, though, it seems to me, Linda, is, yeah, that's great, but if the person is trying to work on being kind, that probably implies that they aren't, that doesn't come naturally to them.
So,
you know, yeah, if they were to be kind, it would reinforce kindness, but they aren't naturally. So
we may be talking about the difference between new conditioning and reconditioning. New conditioning is simply creating a new pathway. People can choose to be kind and they may go more in that direction. The old pattern of being critical is still there in the brain. They're overriding it. They may choose to be kind more often, but under stress, they will probably go back to the old critical habit. So we're talking about also being able to rewire or recondition old patterns, old habits, and reconditioning, which now the neuroscientists can see in their scanners that the neurons holding a network of a memory together can be caused to fall apart, and they'll rewire again a fraction of a second later. But what causes them to fall apart and rewire is the juxtaposition of an opposing, contradictory, disconfirming experience or memory. So if we're working with criticism and compassion, if I can actually evoke a sense of being critical, and I have the feeling in my body, and I have my visual image, and I have my feelings and my thoughts about it, and if I can then also evoke for real a sense of being compassionate, and I can feel that in my body, and I know the visual image of it and the emotions and the thoughts about it, if I can hold those in my awareness in simultaneous dual awareness at the same time, that does take practice, and sometimes people can toggle back and forth. But if I can hold those two experiences in my awareness at the same time, the juxtaposition will cause the neuron to fall apart. They will rewire. And when the experience of compassion is stronger, it will rewire the old experience of the old memory. Well, that's the basis of all trauma therapy. And we've been doing trauma therapy for a while, but now the neuroscientists are able to explain to us what's happening in the brain when we do that.
So you're saying somehow we're practicing or affecting some kind of a practice that holds both ourselves as a critical person, as well as some memory or intention that we want to be kind. We hold that at the same time in what, a guided imagery or a meditation, or exactly, can you get as specific as possible?
So one of the ways that I actually teach people to do this is using a guided imagery exercise called a wish for outcome. So I have the person first remember an experience, especially an experience in a relationship that went awry, didn't go so well, and they can evoke the memory of it, of what they said, what the other person said, what they did, what the other person did, where they were standing, who else was there, the feeling in their body. They light up the network of that memory as much as possible. And then rather than just bringing in an opposite memory, I have them actually begin to imagine a different outcome, a wished for outcome to that scenario. And from a brain perspective, it does not matter if that could have happened in real life or not. So they imagine saying something differently or doing something differently, or the other person saying and doing something different, even if that never could have happened in real life. They can bring in new people who weren't even there at the first time to help out. And they come to a wish for outcome, a different resolution of the scenario. That doesn't rewrite history, but it does rewire the brain. And it doesn't change what happened, but it changes the person's relationship to themselves about what happened. And this is a technique that I teach in workshops all over the country now, and people experience it as very powerful and very transformative. And the changes can be instant and they can be permanent.
Okay, and we do have some research that shows that actually backs that up. Which one were you talking about? Was it new conditioning or... you've got reconditioning, deconditioning, and let's get into that, because so that I was going to do that later, but I'm jumping around. Well, we're jumping around here, and let me follow you and have us go for that now.
Okay, so new conditioning is new experience that creates new patterns or new habits in the brain, and we do that anytime we set an intention to have a new experience or let it register in our awareness and take it into our somatic sense of it. So we do that a lot. Reconditioning uses a positive experience to deliberately rewire an old or traumatizing memory or experience. So that can take a little more practice. It's useful to do that in therapy, and then people learn to do it on their own. The third is deconditioning, which operates in the brain differently. So both new conditioning and reconditioning use the processing in the brain that we call the self-referential network, but it's task-oriented, it's detail-oriented, it makes things happen. The deconditioning uses a more defocused mode of processing in the brain when we're not guiding and controlling what the brain is doing, when we're letting it go into a more open, spacious awareness like a daydream or a reverie. The brain goes into its default network, it's more active than ever, and the brain is actually kind of playing around, making links, creating associations, connecting the dots in a new way, and we're not controlling that. But that's what people experience when they have a sudden insight or epiphany. Or an aha, oh, and that becomes new material that then can be brought back into the client's sense of self and even transform the client's sense of personal self. So we have new experience, new patterns, new habits, reconditioning, which is using the old to rewire, using the new to rewire the old, and then deconditioning, which is kind of letting go and letting something new happen in the brain. We can still guide that some through guided imagery or guided imagination or guided meditation, but the brain is doing it on its own. It's a mental play space for the brain. And then we simply harness it when it comes back into our conscious awareness.
But for a lot of people, let's say, if they let go their brain and their chatter, at, you know, from a mindfulness perspective, goes right back to oh, their grudges or their bitterness or whatever.
So the reason we think that happens in the brain is that when we're letting go of the control of the brain, it's looking for something to do. It's very active. It's playing around. And if we have unresolved grudges or anxieties or bitternesses or trauma, it can latch onto that. And we all know that. We can start ruminating and getting obsessed for hours or for days. So sometimes when we're learning how to do the deconditioning, and we can do this in our mindfulness practice as well, we begin by focusing on something that's benevolent, like focusing on our breath or focusing on someone who loves us or focusing on a benefactor or focusing on a sense of ease and well-being. And then when we sort of let the brain go into its defocused mode of processing, it's already in a safe space. And it experiences what Dan Siegel calls the plane of open possibilities. It's not narrowly focused on one thing, ruminating. It goes more to a sense of possibility. And that's what we're trying to cultivate.
Okay. Now, I had meant to talk about this a little bit earlier, but let's talk about the prefrontal cortex, because you refer to that as the brain's resilience center.
Yes.
Why do you see it that way?
Okay, so most neuroscientists will see the prefrontal cortex as the center of our executive functioning. And It's the most recent structure of the brain to evolve in evolution. It's what develops the latest in the individual human brain. It takes the longest. So it's not fully mature until we're about 25 years of age. Because it's the center of executive functioning, it does many of the things that we need for resilience. It manages the body and our autonomic nervous system. It quells the fear response of the amygdala, the lower brain. It manages all of our emotions as signals to take wise action. It's what we use for attunement and empathy and insight or self-awareness. But also, it is the structure of response flexibility. It is the structure of the brain that allows us to stop and shift gears and respond in a different way, not out of our habit.
Now, I want to stop you for a second, and I just want to say, yeah, that's sort of true, but it's not like I can say, calm down. You know what I mean? I can't make myself, when I'm in a state of arousal, no matter what my prefrontal cortex, you know, I'm thinking, you need to be wise here, you know, you need to calm down.
Well, probably being critical of ourselves for not being calm is not going to help us calm down. That's really true. But here's the trick. We get agitated out of our sense of calm through the autonomic nervous system. We will rev up our sympathetic nervous system into fight, flight, freeze. Or we will actually overactivate the parasympathetic nervous system and we'll go down into too much calm. We'll become lethargic or passive. We'll numb out or we'll collapse. So we want to be able to stay in the window of tolerance. It's this middle ground where we're actually calm and relaxed, but we're engaged and alert. And that's where we can be resilient. That's where the prefrontal cortex can function. So we need tools and techniques to be able to calm ourselves down and come back into that window of tolerance, frankly, so the prefrontal cortex can stay online and think clearly and see what's happening and see our reactions to what's happening and choose a different path. So a lot of the techniques that I offered in Bouncing Back are actually somatic tools to calm down the body and the nervous system first, so then we can begin to think about what else could we do to stay calm.
Okay. Let's just, before we, you've kind of alluded to it and we hadn't really gone into it, you talked about what part of the brain was developed first and so forth, and we got into, we sort of jumped into the prefrontal cortex, but let's talk about the brain development, high brain and low brain and so forth.
Okay. So roughly, basically, the lower brain operates very rapidly and completely unconsciously, and so it doesn't give us very many options. It's about survival. The higher brain operates much more slowly. Sometimes it helps to count to 10 to get the higher brain operating again. It operates consciously, and it's much more comprehensive, so it gives us many, 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 many more options. So a big function of the higher brain or the prefrontal cortex is to regulate the survival responses of the lower brain. They're unconscious. We can change our conscious responses to our survival responses, but that's why we want to stay calm in an equilibrium so that the higher brain can actually stay online functioning and we can actually reflect on what we could do differently.
And actually, when we're in, when we practice meditation, when we practice mindfulness, we develop the skill of interrupting that part of ourselves that is reactive.
Certainly a big part of mindfulness practice is equanimity, which is being able to be with our experience without being reactive to it, either too positive or too negative, facing the eight winds of change from a place of equanimity or equilibrium. So the mindfulness practice is sort of the spiritual correlate of that window of tolerance when we have our physiological equilibrium.
So how do we talked about the role that the higher brain or the prefrontal cortex would have and why it's so crucial for resilience, but how do we train our prefrontal cortex so that it will pick the most resilient response to a situation?
So a lot of what I focused on in the book are the tools that we learn in mindfulness practice and the tools that we learn in an empathy practice, because those are the practices that will strengthen the prefrontal cortex the most. So in empathy, we're actually trying to be able to tune in and understand and have compassion for our own experience and compassion for ourselves as the experiencer of that experience, so that we can calm down, come back into a sense of safety and trust again. That allows the higher brain to keep on functioning. In mindfulness, we're pausing, we're noticing our experience, naming it. That does keep the left hemisphere of the brain online. We're stepping back and disentangling from it so that we're more observing it and reflecting on it. And that allows us to monitor what's going on and modify what's going on. We can shift perspectives, look at things from a different angle. We can discern what our options might be and choose among them wisely. But another benefit of mindfulness practice is over time, we begin to see our thoughts, and our feelings, and patterns of thoughts are patterns, and cascades of feelings are cascades, and our states of being are states. And we begin to see that all of it is a pattern of neural firing. Everything that's happening in our mind, in our brain, is a pattern of neural firing. And that really helps us take it less personally. We still care about ourselves. We still want to behave wisely and respond wisely. But we don't have to get so thrown off center when we understand what's really happening in our brain. And that's particularly important when we have implicit memories that come up from the lower brain. We have a sense of fear or anger or grief, and it can be very powerful and overwhelming. But we may not have a sense that that's a memory. Implicit memories don't have any timestamp. So we're reacting to something that isn't even exactly happening in the present moment. And when we can understand that and be mindful of that, we can just get a little distance from our own reactivity and choose how to respond to it differently.
So all of these processes and strategies can help us stay calm, cool, collected even.
Right.
When we start feeling ourselves, when we're moving into a stressed kind of state, a reactive kind of state, this is sometimes referred to as the window of tolerance,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
this calm place. Can you explain what that is, the window of tolerance, and how it relates to equanimity?
It's simply the physiological equilibrium that we experience in our body when we are calm and relaxed, engaged and alert. So we're not revved up in fear and we're not shut down in fear. It relates to equanimity because equanimity practice is the spiritual correlate of that. What feels most important to me about neuroscience and the window of tolerance is that when we get activated by fear, the stress hormone cortisol is running through our system and that mobilizes us. It's meant to keep us alive and to survive. But the most immediate and direct way to calm down, to antidote that stress hormone of cortisol, is the hormone of oxytocin, which is the hormone of calm and connect. So oxytocin is the hormone of safety and trust, of bonding and belonging, calm and connect. It is the brain's direct and immediate antidote to cortisol. So as soon as we can get the oxytocin released, we can begin to calm down. When we do a simple tool like hand on the heart, we can calm down a panic attack in less than a minute. So I teach my clients many, many ways to activate the release of oxytocin. It's one of the most useful tools they can have.
Tell us some.
So hand on the heart is one of them. There's any warm, safe touch will activate oxytocin, but there are neural cells in the heart that can speed up that activation of oxytocin. Deep breathing into the heart center will activate the parasympathetic and calm us down. When we remember a moment of feeling safe and loved and cherished by someone, a memory or even imagining that to happen, the oxytocin can be released and calm down the cortisol. So I recommend to my clients that they have 20-second full body hugs many times a day. 20 seconds is about 3 breaths, so they can time it with a partner and release the oxytocin. Even remembering, we do know that for the brain, from the brain perspective, remembering a moment of feeling safe and loved and cherished works as effectively as actually being with someone who loves and cherishes us. So many times a day, calling upon memories of feeling safe and loved and cherished, and we can actually stay in our window of tolerance far more effectively.
So why does being around a person who's calm help other people be more relaxed?
Well, the brain does that in several different ways. So the most basic way, again, is from the brainstem, which is right at the base of the skull where the spinal column comes into the skull. And by the way, if you massage the brainstem, it's loaded with oxytocin receptors. So you can actually give yourself a hit of releasing oxytocin. But the brainstem picks up the vibe of other people. If we are around someone who is calm, and if their calm is stronger than our upset, their nervous system is actually regulating our nervous system, and we don't even have to be consciously aware of that happening. But we can use our conscious practice if we make eye contact with someone who is calm and regulated. The fusiform gyrus, which is a small fold of tissue in the visual cortex, and it's what we use to recognize faces and read emotional expressions. If we're looking at eye contact with someone who is calm and we see that in their eyes and in their facial expression, there's a correlation between the activation of the fusiform gyrus and the deactivation of the amygdala. So simply by making eye contact with someone who is calm, we can regulate our own body and nervous system to be calm.
So way back in the beginning, we were talking about people who experienced trauma early in life, and how those people had often a hard time raising their own infants, not because they lacked desire, but because they lacked skill. And really, it may not even be exactly skill as much as they lack the ability to calm themselves down. And if you can't calm yourself down, then it would be hard to have this effect, this calming effect on the infant. Is that trail correct?
Oh, yes.
Would you see it?
That's very correct. And in addition to that, we've discovered that if there's not been a lot of oxytocin in the caregiving relationship, not a lot of holding or cuddling or not a lot of that warm, safe, and connected feeling, then the oxytocin receptors in the child's brain don't develop fully. And it might actually even be harder for them to feel love and safety and connection. And so we have to have practices that actually rebuild the oxytocin receptors in the brain so we can feel the love that in fact is there.
And in your understanding, is that why some people, it's very hard to comfort them or give them they're very uncomfortable, perhaps, getting any kind of positive attention. affection?
If relationship has seemed not comforting, but perhaps even dangerous in the past, then there's a wariness. There's a resistance to taking in. We don't have the receptivity to take in the love that's being offered. So that has to be rebuilt. A lot of what I'm offering in the book is not just developing resilience, but recovering resilience and recovering those capacities. Didn't get them the first time around.
But there are people who actually are seeking tenderness and warmth, but can't accept it when it's there. And I'm thinking that you talked about the oxytocin receptors, like if they haven't had it, they don't have any receptors to take it in if it's genuinely there.
Right. Not enough. I think another thing that can happen is that very often if people didn't grow up with a lot of love and acceptance and maybe don't have a lot of self-love and self-acceptance, then being cared about or receiving love may actually trigger a shame response. I don't deserve this. If you really knew who I was, you wouldn't be doing this. And the shame is what derails the resilience, is what derails the receptivity. So I think a lot of what I'm trying to offer also is using this techniques of neuroplasticity to rewire shame. And reconditioning can be used to rewire shame.
So let's get into that for a minute. Mm-hmm. Rewiring shame. Mm-hmm. How would we, what would you suggest?
Okay. So when there are experiences of love and acceptance from another person, and we're trying to help that translate to a sense of love and acceptance of the self, then that is what can rewire an experience of loathing or self-hatred. The networks have to both be lit up at the same time. It takes a lot of mindfulness and compassion to hold that in a container. It can take a lot of practice to do that. I think it takes a lot of conscious processing. One of my favorite interventions with clients these days is, what are you noticing? What are you noticing? What are you noticing? So noticing the love coming from a true other to the true self, noticing the reaction inside, is it being received or rejected? Noticing what happens when you try to evoke a sense or a memory of self-love, self-acceptance, what happens when you juxtapose that with the self-loathing? So a lot of mindfulness and compassion, but reconditioning is the tool that can do that. When we do it over and over and over.
And you talked in your book about being around people who are calm and how that can transmit calmness to the stressed out person. And you talked about two structures in the brain that contribute to that, the vagus nerve and the fusiform gyrus. Mm-hmm. You've gone into a bit on the fusiform gyrus, mm-hmm. but let's go into the vagus nerve just a little bit. How is that related?
So the vagus nerve, as we've been learning from Stephen Porges, both regulates our survival responses, but it also regulates the social engagement system so that when we look at someone else's facial expressions and see that they're calm, that registers through the mirror neurons, that registers. And we can calm down our own nervous system as well. It does what he calls, puts on the vagal brake. So that when we have good vagal tone and we're actually being able to engage with other people socially, that helps regulate the fear response of the amygdala. It just doesn't come up as much.
A while back you talked about cortisol and its effect. Too much cortisol affects the hippocampus. Mm-hmm. But a low level of cortisol... Can a low level of cortisol also affect the hippocampus as well?
You know, we use a mild stimulation of the sympathetic nervous system all the time when we're out exploring and creating and producing and relating to people. So it's not that being activated is always negative. It's just whether there's a lot of fear associated with it. So one of the things that we can do, we can prime our brain to not be so reactive or responsive to the cortisol. So not only can oxytocin calm down the brain once the stress is activated, but it can actually prevent it or preempt it. So we're discovering that if oxytocin is already flowing in the system, events that might cause a stress reaction actually don't. there's just sort of a preemption of the stress response. And so one of the things that we could talk about was the study that Jim Cohen did at Richie Davidson's lab at the University of Wisconsin, where he had three groups of women going through the fMRI scanner as they were being told that they were going to get a slightly unpleasant electrical shock on their ankle. So the first group of women in the scanner by themselves reported pain when the shock actually happened, anxiety in anticipating it. The group of women who were holding the hand of the lab technician while they were in the scanner, a stranger but another human being, reported less anxiety and less pain when the shock happened. The group of women who were holding the hands of their husbands not only reported no anxiety and no pain, but they reported a pleasant experience because they were holding the hand of someone who loved them. The oxytocin flowing in the brain preempted the stress response. So we're learning how to use what's going on in our brain to actually manage or preclude our stress responses in the first place.
Thank you. That's very interesting research. I think not everyone knows about that, and it does illustrate very well what we're trying to talk about here. So this was fun. I appreciate your time and all of the work you've done. Again, Linda's book is Bouncing Back, Rewiring Your Brain for Maximum Resilience and Well-Being. Thanks very much for being part of our series.
Thank you, Ruth. I enjoyed it very much.